Support comes from the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado, a proud partner of the public broadcasting stations that keep Coloradans better informed.
Welcome to Outsources. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth. Today was the National Day of Mourning for those sickened and those lost by COVID. And I would add the other losses people around the world have faced. It's been a week of anger and despair, sparked by yet another murder of an innocent black or brown person at the hands of the police. The most recent victim was George Floyd, most recently preceded by Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. I went back into the archives and retrieved several thoughtful and helpful Outsources interviews and settled on this one. It's the very articulate Reverend Alicia Ford, who now leads the Unitarian Universalist Association as the director of the International Office. You might think the next clip of a speech by her was given this weekend at a rally, and this interview could almost be tonight. But it was back in 2015, still very relevant. Join me.
To be ready to be bolder, to get involved, and we have to keep showing up. We have to be ready to seize the urgency of the day. We have to be ready to topple the current social order, launching a different way of being in America. Isn't that what Jesus did? Topple the social order of his day? Isn't that what Parks did, and King did, and Stokely Carmichael did?
Yes.
State-sanctioned violence is not new. Being executed without cause is not new. And perhaps like you, I keep asking, how good do we have to be? How well-dressed? Well-spoken? How much should we earn? What degrees? What measures can we and should we take to prove that we belong here and we are in fact born free.
I'm your host, Karen Rayforth, and in the studio tonight, we're pleased to have Reverend Alicia Roxanne Ford. She has a Master's in Divinity from the Iliff School of Theology, and she spends a lot of her professional time doing continuing education and professional development for the clergy of the Unitarian Universalists. She also is born and raised in Trinidad and Tobago. She's of African descent and describes herself as a queer cisgender woman. So let's talk just a little bit about your professional life. You know, some of in the queer community are a little nervous around organized religion, and here you are as part of your profession. How do you reconcile your queerdom and your many different identities actually in with your work with Unitarian Universalist clergy?
I think that religion in the United States is not without its problems. There are many that one can point to, and religious organizations are cultural institutions. They're not ahistorical or acultural or apolitical. You know, they come with history and baggage, and some of that baggage looks like perpetuating injustices. That's just true, and it's what we live with. If I were to pick on Christianity for a minute, and more conservative forms of Christianity, you'll find that they espouse ways of being that are especially harmful to people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, people who identify as women, whether that's trans or cis women, economically disenfranchised people. That certainly exists in our religious landscape. But then you also have progressive religious movements like Unitarian Universalism, the United Church of Christ, the Metropolitan Community of Christ, that are seeking to reclaim a certain kind of reverence, help us think more deeply about what it means to be fully human and to be fully alive in today's world and to ground ourselves in movements for justice and for social transformation. So for me, spirituality and social transformation go hand in hand. They're not separate. I align myself with the Unitarian Universalists because I really felt moved by their seven principles, the first of which is affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I can get behind that. And that is, for me, a theological statement, but it's also a justice statement. Yes, religion is problematic, and I want to stop short of saying all religion is problematic. I do think there are some religious homes that are capable of embracing, and they do it imperfectly, but we know we're learning organizations and we're learning beings.
And it sounds like it's helpful that the religious institution that you are tied to does deeply see social justice as an important piece, not just charity work, which many religious institutions believe in charity work, which to me is very different than social justice.
Right. I'm nodding because I totally agree with you. I think there are a number of ways in which Unitarian Universalism tries to be not necessarily on the forefront, but in the mix and in the midst of social transformation movements. And so that's important to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have, you say, deep roots in Tobago. Well, for one thing, some people aren't probably really even sure where Tobago is, since many of us are geographically impaired. But how does that inform your life now, your professional and personal life?
Oh, that is a big question. So where is it? So I'm going to tell your listeners to pull out a map after the show. Find South America, find Venezuela, and if you look just above it, there are two tiny dots labeled Trinidad and Tobago. So I grew up on the island, and a little dot you can barely see called Tobago. You know, the truth is I have not ever really forgotten where I'm from. That's a hard thing to do if you've grown up in some place for 20 years. I am definitely grounded there. It's a very specific place that was colonized by quite a few European countries, the British leaving the most lasting legacy because they were the last to leave. It's not true that while I was growing up there that I was really awake to the lasting effects of colonialism, but stepping away, I'm certainly more in tune with the fact that I grew up in a colonized country and that that had a certain impact on my being and my education and the way I saw the world.
Can you give us an example of what you mean?
A simple example is how one thinks about language. My mom would always say to me, "Speak the Queen's English." Now, I didn't even know the Queen from Adam. So what did it mean to do that? And why wasn't like our dialect enough? Why was that such a terrible thing to have a dialect that just worked? Why did we have to reach for more? What does speaking the Queen's English mean about someone? There's also a lasting legacy of shadism or colorism on the islands, and what benefits one gets by being lighter skinned. Those are two examples that impacted my growing up there. The legacy that it's left me with is when moving here is to think about American imperialism and globalism and how all of those things play out in a global landscape. Having the ability to both embrace what's positive about living here and the way in which I think sometimes American foreign policy overreaches.
There's an important movement in our country that some of us call Black Lives Matter, and it's a movement. What is the meaning of that for you? I mean, it means different things to different people.
It's actually a great question, and it's great that you pointed out that it means different things to different people. I was also amused that you said some of us call it Black Lives Matter because some of us don't. Well, I feel like it's this generation's iteration of the quest for justice, but definitely on their terms, done in such a way that I don't think that folks are apologizing for what they see as their own desire and thirst and hunger for justice and justice now, and an unwillingness to really compromise a vision, one, and two, an unwillingness to accept that the way in which race and racial dynamics play out in this country is okay. And that's anything from the school to prison pipeline, mass incarceration, the levels of poverty that Black and brown people face in the United States, to the spate of murders that we've been seeing as a result of state-sanctioned violence. And those aren't new. Social media has made it so that, you know, we can't look away anymore.
Right. But it's a continuing, actually, legacy and saga that many have been able to turn away from and never see.
Or right.
Many people who have the skin color that I do have been able to look away and to be able to say, I had no idea.
Right.
How could this be happening with outrage, which is appropriate, but the question of this is new? No.
Exactly. It's not new. And, you know, I think this movement is also shining a light on the fact that we keep waiting for the perfect victim. We keep waiting for that, you know, perfect angelic person who we can say, oh, look, that person definitely didn't deserve to die. But the truth is, what we've been seeing is no one deserves to die based on any of the things that have been unfolding in the media. The punishment for walking in the street is not death. That is completely unjust, and it's tyranny. And so I feel like part of what we're seeing is just, I don't know if it's tiredness, but it's kind of, it feels like decades old of outrage just erupting. Social media has a hand in making it spread the way it has. It's well past time. I have more to say. But
I think that just like having the perfect victim, one thing I've noticed is somehow I'm hoping that people are catching on that the first few of these that really popped up in social media, at least to the to white people's or majority people's attention, there was a sense of, well, there's sometimes a bad cop involved. And the particularizing of it being one bad apple and not looking at the system that is sick. I mean, yes, there are bad apples. There's bad apples in every group, every career, every population, whatever. That's always true. It's that, it's a both and way of looking at things of, it's not going to work to say, well, we'll bring that bad apple to justice when we're letting the system continue on, which is that mass incarceration, education to prison pipeline, all the way to the fight about the death penalty and who's on death row in this country.
I would totally agree with you. I think it's important to indict police officers when things like this go down, like so when there are unjust murders. But it's also important to think about the ways in which the prison system is constructed and ways in which law enforcement is constructed and what it is we give those who act on behalf of the state, what kind of license we give them in terms of how they interact with the public, especially with people who are black and brown. It's interesting to me that one of the things we don't hear about is that the murder rate of Native Americans as a result of state-sanctioned violence is extraordinarily high based upon just how many Native Americans are within the United States population. And that's not part of our public discourse at the moment in time.
The percentage is high.
Exactly.
And it's, they're so small. We've decimated most of them.
And so we don't have conversations about that. What we do is place responsibility on individuals for whatever situations they find themselves with. And then we try to tell people that when encountering the police, here is how you should behave, rather than thinking about how law enforcement agencies are constructed, educated, and taught to interact with the public, especially black and brown people. I was looking on internet recently and saw a young white male, he must have been 20 or 21 because he was drunk, was pulled over for DWI. He was both drunk and I think marijuana was involved somewhere. And he took selfies in at the police station with the police officer. And I kept thinking, how is that okay? Not the fact that he took selfies. That's neither here nor there. But if that were a black body, it would be a completely different story. Mm-hmm. And why are we okay with that?
Right. If that were typically how it went at the police station for everyone, which I've never even heard of such a thing, that would be different. Well, it also points up an interesting question, an interesting reaction that I have heard in different parts of our queer community and elsewhere. When people hear Black Lives Matter, sometimes their response is, well, yeah, but what about, and then fill in the blank, some other group's lives matter, kind of in parentheses, two exclamation point, an immediate press to jump every disenfranchised group onto that phrase. How do you understand all that? Or what is it? It's kind of back to that question of what is the Black Lives Matter slogan even mean, or where did it come from, that I think people don't know.
I won't be able to recap you know, how the founders thought about that hashtag they created after the verdict came down for the Trayvon Martin case in 2013. But I can tell you how I understand it, is that until Black lives are free and have liberation in the United States, then none of us can be free. And that's not about what's happening in this moment only. It really is about this country's history of enslavement, and in the particularly the enslavement of Black bodies. Mm-hmm. And so the hashtag Black Lives Matter isn't founded on nothing. It's not, again, it's not ahistorical. It comes out of somewhere and it's speaking to something very specific. The bodies that are most oppressed or most marginalized in the United States are Black and brown bodies. On the one hand, I can appreciate the impulse to say, well, X lives matter also. And that's true. No one is actually denying that. What it's shining a spotlight on is it's really hard to say all lives matter when you look at the statistics and you look at, you know, the overall treatment of Blacks in America. There is no evidence that Black lives matter too. I think it's really important to just keep holding that statement in front of the American mm-hmm. public until it becomes a reality. And it's not going to become a reality by itself. It really does require a dedication and a commitment to love and justice.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Outsources. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth, and I'm interviewing Alicia Roxanne Ford on love and justice.
How do you get out of bed, you know, some days, you know, in the face of a continual injustice and racial violence and driving here? You know, there some people talk about driving while Black.
Mm-hmm.
That's dangerous.
That's real.
Just
yeah.
Walking outside your home, staying in your own home for that matter.
You're right. There are ways in which many people who identify as people who are Black or people who are brown don't feel safe in their homes. I feel fortunate that I feel like my home is a sanctuary. And when I go in there, I sort of get to craft that space. For me, it's a healing space. And I get to decide who comes in and who stays out. For now, I mean, that may not always be true, because there's certainly cases in which it's not true. I'm thinking about Ayanna Stanley, who was, you know, 7 and police raided her home. And that was, you know, that was the end of her really young life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I know it's not true for everyone that home is sanctuary, but for now, for me, that's true. And my family is a real place of grounding. I talk to my niece maybe 4 times a week. She's about 20, well, she's 25, she'll be 26, uh-huh, you know. Uh-huh. And those kinds of touchstones, my niece, my mom, my partner, that's my bedrock, and I don't think I could survive without them. Close friends who do not live in Colorado, all of whom identify as people of color, and though we're geographically separated, you know, they too are my sanctuary, because they can, you know, they can sort of empathize and get, and we can just be real with each other about what's going on. And that really matters to me.
How do you fold in some of your identities around the queer identity with Black identity? I mean, some people say you can be Black but not queer, or you can be queer but not Black. I mean, you're perceived one way or the other. It's almost like we dichotomize. Or do you feel one part of your identity gets erased at the expense of the other? Or?
So I moved here in 1992, and I moved because I had this sneaking suspicion that I might be a lesbian. I don't think I had that word at the time. And at the time, there was no way to just explore what that meant back at home. I moved to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and decided that the next right thing to do would be to join the military, which it's really hard to explore one's
Whoa.
Identity in the military. It was possible because of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Cheyenne, Wyoming. I found it about maybe 3 years after joining the military and being stationed in Cheyenne. And what I found there was a space that was both theologically grounding. It was a good theological match, because I'm not Christian. I don't identify as such. And a place where no one seemed to have a problem with somebody who is not heterosexual. So it was a very good place to begin to sort out what does it mean to be lesbian. And in the years since I've begun to identify as queer, and that's actually a more meaningful designation for me, being a part of Unitarian Universalism has meant, yes, I'm queer, and that's good, and people can see that, and people can appreciate that. And the struggles that I tend to have is around, what does it mean to be a person of color in a denomination that is 88% white and 2% African descent? So the struggle I have is really navigating a denomination that's really clear about how it supports LGBTQI folks, but still really learning about its own internalized racism, its own privilege, mm-hmm. and how to mm-hmm. best be in relationship with people who are both Unitarian Universalists and a person of color, and people who are outside of Unitarian Universalism and people of color.
Well, it does point out something in that apparently the Unitarian Universalists are kind of on the same page with the mainstream around. There's been many wonderful advances for the queer community this year. Still many to go. Some wonderful advances, and yet it seems like almost like on a parallel path, erosion of reproductive rights, erosion of the voting rights that sprang from incredible inequities in the South, but actually have popped up all over the country. The threat on civil rights in so many different directions. So it's almost like in some quarters, at least for the moment,
right,
that queers ascending in rights and other groups maybe descending and or not getting anywhere. And you're holding several of these identities where things are going up in some ways and going down in others.
I think that's an argument for our social justice movements cannot be siloed, and they can't be single issue. We can't have a single issue justice movement. So we can't just focus on queer rights without thinking about what does it mean when somebody is queer, a person of color, disabled. Like, we can't be economically disenfranchised. We have to find a way to hold all of those things together and find solutions that work for the whole rather than keeping them in boxes, because that doesn't work. And I don't know that we're not yet that savvy, I think, mm-hmm. in how we think about our justice movements. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean to be insulting when I say we're not that savvy. It's just it's a difficult way, I think, to think about how we approach change.
Some of the intersections, I mean, we all cognitively know people hold many identities, and yet we interact with each other one at a time almost sometimes.
Right.
And in our social justice work, and there is that silo, different boxes approach, and it's a way to separate us from my perspective. Mm-hmm. And yet it's tough sometimes to get our queer community to try to role model and lead in those intersections of identity and to really embrace, it's taken many years to embrace the trans community.
Right.
It's been many years of trying to see why voting rights or immigration or civil rights for Black and brown people are so key to white, middle-upper-class queer folks that are, you know, highly educated, whatever, you know, I've got mine, now
right.
what? How do we get people to see our liberation and freedoms tied together?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Isn't it?
So one of the things I thought about and I think about a lot is how do we use the platforms that we have to educate, and how do we use the connections that we have to educate and to always be about love and justice? Like, just that's just who we are in the world. And that's not going to be true of everybody. But for those of us who do this kind of work, how do we just constantly think about that? You know, I'm preaching on Sunday, and I was like, well, I'm going to do this pastoral sermon about growing our souls. Having a really difficult time thinking about how to talk about that separate from love and justice. Yesterday, I just finally gave in and thought they're one and the same. That is the thing that I just need to keep talking about. Everything I do has to be filtered through that lens. Everything I do has to be filtered through an intersectional lens. And I don't care if you think I'm a one sermon person. I will repackage it in a million ways until we get it. My invitation to people is to think about the connections they have and the platforms they have and to use those and to be learners instead of knowers, which is something I like to talk about at work. We want to develop this knowing culture, right? Like we have information and we'll give it. And that's fine, but the reality is we're learners and there's always more to learn. And so we never stop. Like when you think about buying a house, you gather a certain amount of knowledge, you go to the expert, the realtor, and you figure out how to get it done. When you're thinking about how to make the world a more just place, there is a bank of knowledge that you can go to. There are people that you can partner with. There are places that you can be involved to figure out how to make it happen. And that, for people who are white, might include dismantling some of your privilege. And that means you have to examine it, and that means you might come up against your resistance, and you'll be uncomfortable, and all of that is absolutely okay. No one ever died from being uncomfortable.
And learning is ultimately very reinforcing,
right?
Even though there's maybe a discomfort in the beginning, just like the first time you learned how to ride a bike.
Right.
It wasn't the greatest experience, probably, the very first few moments, but then
you practice.
You get better, and it's like, this is kind of cool.
Yeah. Pretty soon you're riding down Pearl Street on Thursday night with a bunch of people singing Happy Thursday. And by that I mean you find allies or accomplices building this world that's liberatory. So you don't have to do it alone.
So what astonished you today? Or this week?
Today.
This is the Mary Oliver
yeah.
quote you have out there.
Today I had the good fortune of hiking with a colleague. It was we were having a meeting. It's the best kind of meeting. What astonished me, I think, was his capacity for joy and recognizing people's passion and drawing that out and helping me remember my own passions. Because it's really easy when doing the work I do or being invested in social change, it's really easy to feel tired. And it's really easy to feel discouraged a lot. And it's also really helpful to have those people who point you back to your grounding, back to your being, and help you remember like the big picture of why you do this work, one, and you don't have to do it alone. You may never see the fruits in your lifetime, but that doesn't mean that you stop. I think my astonishment was, I didn't expect that out of this meeting. But
I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much. You've been listening to the very articulate Reverend Alicia Ford from the Unitarian Universalist Association. She had a lot to tell us about love and justice. We need to learn from the disaster folks who say, build back better. From COVID, from so many other poisons in our country and the world. That includes understanding how inextricably we are connected as a community, that there are deep implications in not treating the community members, as Dr. Martin Luther King would say, beloved community. We must all take responsibility for dealing with racism, white supremacy, and other poisons. We need to get more deeply educated and involved. Take action. There are many ways to do so. See outsources on kgnu.org or news.kgnu.org. Be a constant learner, like Alicia said. Reach out to an organization like joincampaignzero.org. Learn about how we can change policing in this country. Help somebody. You'll feel better, and we can build back better together. Join us every Monday night at 6:30, or find us on KGNU or the news blog, news.kgnu.org. Have a peaceful evening.